And welcome to Backstage Pass, a spinoff of the Rock and Roll Survivors podcast, dedicated to those in front of the curtain, behind the curtain, and somewhere in between. I'm Kristen, and I'll be talking with music writers, podcasters, photographers, promoters, groupies, and so many others who love rock and roll. So here's your Backstage Pass. Let's get started. And welcome back to Backstage Pass. Madeline Baccaro, author, extraordinary author of the book In Your Mind, The Infinite Universe of Yoko Ono. Welcome back to episode 4. And we talked a little bit about on episode 3, how John and Yoko met. We talked a little bit about Yoko's two artistic conceptual art pieces, Cut and Yes. But then we also talked about that there was an 18 months gap between them getting together. It was because they were both married. There was that. But I now want to talk a little bit about your beautiful chapter, Marilyn Baccaro, which is when John and Yoko get together. So welcome back. And I can't wait to talk to you about all of this.
Thank you so much, Kristen.
So the chapter on John and Yoko, and there's so much more to it. I have to say again, the thing I love about this book, and it really does bear repeating, is this is, and I can't think of a more corny word, but it's like a beautiful mosaic or a tapestry, because you can follow one thread perfectly, but then you realize how interconnected it is back and forth. And you really do such a great job with making sure a lot of voices are brought into the story so that it's not just her voice to round it out. So the chapter about John and Yoko is called When Two Clouds Meet. And I want to quote a little bit from you before we delve in. And well, this is actually a quote from John Lennon in his Skywriting by Word of Mouth. And he says, quote, "I finally met Yoko and the dream became a reality," close quote. And you write, Madeline, "On the night that changed his life forever, November 7th, 1966, John Lennon visited Yoko Ono's unfinished paintings and objects exhibition on the evening before its opening at Indica Gallery in London. John's bite of Yoko's apple, a modern tale of Adam and Eve, East meets West, began the ballad of John and Yoko. This was the start of many turbulent yet exciting years for the infamous couple. They would dedicate their eternal union to promoting peace," close quote. And I want to hear more about this, but I think it really is important to note that those years together were only 12 years. And look what they've done. So tell us a little bit about John and Yoko getting together, but you have a wonderful pre-story. And I'd like you to set the stage for all of us.
So of course, Yoko was an avant-garde artist before she met John. She was 33 when she met him. But in 2 months before they met, in September 1966, there was the Destruction in Art Symposium held in London, organized by Gustav Metzger. So Yoko and her second husband, Tony Cox, performed a cut piece there and a couple of other things. But she wasn't a very destructive person, of course. She was all about peace. So the piece that Gustav selected for her to do of her own was called Whisper Piece. And it was about the destruction of a word once it goes from ear to ear and is whispered. And what comes out at the end, we don't know. But at the end of it, she said, "I don't want to hear it." So that's what she's about. But anyway, Metzger lectured at the university where Pete Townsend attended art school. And Pete Townsend said some very cool things about Yoko. And he said about the events at the symposium, "Gustav Metzger came to my college to lecture, and Yoko did that thing where she had her clothes cut up. And the next thing I know, I'm breaking up guitars at gigs. The guitar became, when it was electrified, in my case, an instrument of control, aggression, and latent violence. People say it's just a stagecraft, just showing off, smashing your guitar. To me, it was far more than that." And about Yoko, he says, "People fail to understand that in the mid-60s, Yoko was an agitator, a revolutionary who used peaceful techniques to shock us into a reaction. Her message has always been about saving the world. Smashing a guitar may seem as pointless as singing inside a bag, but the point is, art itself must find new ways of shaking people out of their stupor. Art must shock, agitate, and even irritate. It isn't for putting on the wall. That is decoration, equally valid, but a very different thing.
Wow.
So Pete really got it from the beginning.
Pete got it from the beginning, and it reminds me of Yoko Ono's idea of a chair is a chair until you burn it, and then it's not a chair, but it's still in your mind.
Exactly.
And he's taking his guitar in that same way, and the destruction of it. That's fantastic. So this is now 2 months prior to John seeing Yoko Ono's work the evening before. So set the stage a little bit. We talked about it, but just in case, I would love viewers to this moment, and then we'll get to 18 months later.
Okay, so John had been filming How I Won the War in Almeria, Spain, and he comes back to London. You know, this is after the shocking news of their manager's death, you know, and he's just kind of in a daze and he's looking for something, you know, something to save him, really. He had written the song Strawberry Fields about somebody I think is in my tree. And his original lyrics to that was somebody on my wavelength. And that was Yoko that he was looking for.
Wow.
So, you know, he goes to her opening at Indica Gallery the night before the opening, and he sees her standing there, and she doesn't know who the Beatles are, really. She might have heard of them peripherally, but she's like, who is this guy coming in here? Because the gallery owner, John Dunbar, had brought him. And Dunbar says to her, you know, be nice to this guy. He might buy something. So she says, okay. And she lets him look around. And he, first thing he sees is the hammer and nail painting. And he says, God, can I hammer a nail in? And she said it was all white and she didn't want it ruined before the opening. And she said, no, not really. And he said, well, how about if I hammer an imaginary nail for imaginary 5 shillings? So she says, okay, he's got my game. You know, this is fine. So, and fun, one of the reviews of my book is you hit the imaginary nail on the imaginary head. So that's.
I read that. And that's wonderful. I love that connection.
Yeah. So then he sees the white ladder that leads up to the painting on the ceiling. It looks blank, but there's a magnifying glass hanging down. And he goes up there to find a tiny little word that says yes. And up till then, he was really pessimistic about art, you know, the avant-garde scene, but it said something positive to him. So that was it. That just lit his fuse. And he got it. And he always kept her in his mind. They didn't get together for 18 months after that because they were both married. They both had small children. And she went away to Paris to do some work there, and she wasn't really going to go back to London because she was at the Nook Film Festival in Belgium and they were all going back to London, and she said, no, I'll never go back to London. Paris was fun, but she said, you know, our feelings were getting too close to danger because she knew how heavy the scene would be if she got together with him. And but they were corresponding by mail, and when she did finally get back to London from Paris, there was a pile of letters there from John. And she's like, oh my God, this is unavoidable.
Oh, wow. Mm-hmm. Have those letters survived?
I think so, yeah.
Did he have to use a pen name?
No, he was very honest. And it was just sweet stuff they were writing back and forth, so.
No, I just mean like if I was a mail person, well, I mean, I guess you're not allowed to.
No, there's like collections of postcards from the Beatles all to each other and they don't use it. Hey, Ringo, it's John. It's crazy.
That is crazy. We live in a different world now. I love that. So one of the things that I did not know, not that I'm at all a Beatles aficionado, but I'm a fan, is the song Hey Jude. Well, I knew the part that it was originally Hey Jules, as in Julian Lennon.
Right.
From your book, I didn't realize, and if you listen to the lyrics, and I'm going to let everybody go listen to the lyrics now, that it was Paul McCartney's way of telling John Lennon that he's giving his approval to go be with Yoko Ono.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it started out for Julian, and it is somewhat, you know, but if you're listening to it, it's like you're waiting for someone to perform with. The kid was 8 years old. Yeah. And or go out. You have found her. Now go and get her. And the most telling line is when he says, so let it out and let it in. Because at the Indica Gallery, the first thing Yoko did was handed John a card that said breathe. And that's one of her pieces. So yeah, that's all that.
Well, I think that's great. And Byron Wilkins, who was this podcast's engineer, who was a huge Beatles fan, he didn't know that either. So I didn't feel quite so dumb. But it's great trivia. And I love, again, I want readers to go out and read your book on this. Great stuff in here. And so John and Yoko are now together and they have this united dream of bringing peace to the world. And one of the connections that you and I have is about their first album together. I've always known it as Two Virgins, but it's Unfinished Music Number One.
Two
And
virgins,
so,
part of the title, yes.
right, part of the title. So I want to tell the listeners the connections, but I want to hear from you, Madeline, about it, the other side of it. So it's now November 1968, if I'm getting the time right. And they, Two Virgins, it's an album. And so my father, Roy Silver, who was a manager and producer at the time, he owned a management company and an agency in Beverly Hills, California, called Campbell Silver Cosby. Campbell was for Bruce Campbell, Roy Silver, my dad, and Cosby being Bill Cosby. And Bill Cosby was so hot with his comedy albums that my dad wanted to come up with an idea to do a record label in-house as opposed to giving royalties away to another record label. And so he created Tetragrammaton Records, which not only put out Two Virgins in the US, and we'll talk about how that happened, but also Deep Purple's first album. And you have in your book a little blurb about Tetragrammaton, but there's one thing I wanted to add, which a lot of people don't know, which is the name Tetragrammaton. Yes, it does mean an unnamed Hebrew god, if you will. And my dad was Jewish. But my dad, everything he did had great intention in terms of PR. And the reason why he selected Tetragrammaton Records was because it had the word gram in it, like Grammy, which is the idea. So, and that was really his meaning behind it. It was more the idea of Tetragrammaton had that ring to it.
That's cool.
So I wanted to set the stage as you talk about the album and their meaning and intent behind it. So my mom and dad are still married, and it's in 1968, and they fly from Los Angeles over to London. They land in Heathrow, and they go to the recording of the White Album at Apple Records. And I remember saying to my mom, what songs were you listening to? And she said, you have to remember we hadn't heard them yet, which was always such a trip to me. But and they all sat around in a big circle. They obviously weren't recording, my dad and mom and the Beatles. And they all smoked a joint together. My mom remembers John passing my mom the doobie, and they touched fingers. My mom never forgot it. And so the idea was to see if John and Yoko liked my dad enough to let Two Virgins be distributed through Tetragrammaton. And so the photo shoot happens, the famous photo shoot where they're naked. And of course, that was considered pornography at the time. And my mom and dad had to figure out how to bring those photographs. It couldn't be film, obviously, that would be destroyed through X-rays or whatever and would be too heavy. So they had to take the actual photographs and they were sewn in the lining of my mother's fur jacket so that when they went through
Awesome.
Heathrow, that they weren't caught. I asked my mom if she was nervous. She said she was so nervous, but she was a great actress. There's, if you Wikipedia this story now, it says that my mom hid the photos in her lingerie suitcase. My mom did not have a lingerie suitcase. It was just one suitcase. And also, that would have been such an obvious go-to for anybody searching. So, no, it was in the lining of her fur coat. So they get home to LA, and I still have the telegram that John sent to my dad saying that he and Yoko basically are agreeing to let him distribute Two Virgins. And it says only Lennon says you are cool, and says
Awesome.
is spelled SEZ.
Oh,
So that's my side of Two Virgins. Now tell us everything from your side.
so for my side, about the cover photograph, actually, is they shot that with a timer on a by themselves, and of course everybody cleared the room, and but of course everybody was going to see this picture in the whole world, and it's kind of funny that they had to do it in private like that. And they said, they wanted to just seem natural and that there were better pictures of them looking a little better, but they didn't want to appear doctored or anything. They just wanted to show the equality of themselves with everyone else. So that was their point, I guess, you know. But it was John's idea to have them naked because he first thought of recording Yoko alone. And he was going to just have her naked on the album because she was just, her work was all about like innocence and, you know, just very pure. And he thought that would be it. But it so happened that the first album she made was with him. So this was their first date, actually. So it's May 1968. You know, he finally has the nerve to call her up and say, you know, he's alone, his wife was away. He says, you know, come take a car, I'll pay for it, come over. So she comes and they're really awkward. They don't know what to say to each other, even though they're so brilliant, whatever. So what do? They get high because he says, we can sit and talk or we can go upstairs and make some music. So she opted for the music, right? So they get high and they're just playing around with these tapes. This is like their first date on record. It's just, that's what it is.
I
So it's
love
like unprecedented. It's a sound collage, and the unfinished concept is inspired by her group book, Grapefruit. And they both thought that sound is in the mind of the listener, you know, not in the grooves of a record. And John said, you know, it was just us expressing ourselves like a child does, however he feels like then. What we're saying is make your own music. This is unfinished music. So, you know, they felt like they were two innocents lost in a world gone mad. Like they were not the mad ones. The world was mad. And, you know, they supposedly consummated their relationship at dawn that night. So, you know, it's the sounds of two avant-garde artists falling in love, noodling with tapes and wordless vocals. And, you know, that's what it is. And Sean is really cool. He says, you're listening to John and Yoko falling in love and having fun in the studio alone. It was just my dad and mom. You're hearing that natural love explosion.
Oh, that's just beautiful. And talk a little bit more about how Yoko perceived. Well, first of all, the nude photos, and then how it had to be wrapped in brown paper and what that symbolized.
Well, you know, somebody said, how did you feel about them putting a paper bag over it? And she said, well, we thought it was the next step of our performance art, you know, somebody completing the thought like we meant for them to do. And she said, in a way, the cover was side one. It got you so much more, you know, impact and attention. So they loved it. They thought it was great.
I love that. Well, let's talk a little bit more about, I mean, this was on an album. There's sounds, but they also were visual artists, and he really picked up on her concept art, or as she jokingly calls it, con art. So talk to us a little bit about their famous bed-ins for those who remember these images, and if not, you can Google them.
Sure. So the bed-ins were a year later. Before that, though, like around the same time of the Two Virgins album, they made a film called Two Virgins. And it was pretty much the soundtrack of the album with a film of John and Yoko separate at first, kissing and whatever. And at the end, their faces merge perfectly. And you can see like they're really one person. It's uncanny how their eyes line up and their mouth and their nose and how much alike they look.
Does this
So
film still exist? I'm assuming it does.
it's, you know, it's rarely shown, but I'm sure they'll show it at some of her exhibitions coming up. But that's the only place they've ever really been shown except at film festivals when they came out.
Oh,
But it's
I
beautiful.
love that they did that.
Yeah, and they did several films together, but then in 69, so they get married and they were going to go on a honeymoon, and the press was everywhere. And they said, look, you know, since we have all this media attention, why don't we do something important? And the bed-in was totally Yoko. Let's sit in bed, you know, for a week and encourage people to just think about peace. And that's what they did. You know, they invited the press. And every day it was all day, all day, all day of press from all around the world. And they just kept promoting peace like it was dish soap. That's what John said. You know, it's like a co big, biggest commercial for peace. And people laughed at them. You know, they thought it was naive. But guess what? Everybody was watching and listening. They just wore all white. Everything in the room was white, representing a surrender, a flag of surrender. And, you know, this is John following Yoko's lead. And then they just took the stage and did the Acorn event, and they did concerts together because she's now following him and he's becoming an avant-garde artist and she's becoming a rock star. And they're kind of just merging and running with it.
And this is also at the height of the war, Vietnam War. And so we are also, what they were talking about was incredibly controversial, to be anti-war with an anti-war sentiment. And you had said about the white being pure and that they wanted to show, give peace a chance. But there was also a bit of a cynical backlash, as if the media was questioning what they were doing and questioning whether they were really seeking peace or if this was just another exploitation to keep them in the spotlight. And of course, there's really nothing you can detach from Yoko Ono, which is the fact that she was Japanese. And there was a lot of anti-Japanese sentiment going on at the time. We spoke a little bit about that previously. But she was not necessarily as well received as, let's say, a Linda Eastman. And so she was very much, I don't know, seen as the fall person, if you will, and a lot to blame. So I'm wondering if you could talk about the negative responses that they both received by these give peace a chance ideas, and also still to this day being blamed somehow for breaking up the Beatles.
Well, you know, I think the main perception was their Beatle is now gone off the deep end, you know, so there's that. They feel like they're losing John, they're losing the Beatles, they've lost the Beatles, whatever. And yes, the anti-Japanese sentiment and all that. But at the time, I don't think she felt it as much as John did, because they didn't tell her face directly, but they would tell John, what are you doing with her? You know, be careful, she'll slit your throat in the middle of the night. He got these letters, he got voodoo dolls shaped like her with pins in them, you know, and whether she knew or not, Yoko worked in a vacuum. This is her mission. Art is her life. And she was just blindly, you know, going about it because she had to. And she wasn't going to let all that affect her. She felt it a lot later on when John was gone, because he wasn't there to protect her as much. But, you know, she took the brunt of it. But she also said that it was like a lot of little stabs of acupuncture, where you're taking all these jabs, but eventually you use it to make yourself feel good. And she just always turned everything into a positive.
I'm learning that about her, thanks to you. I just think she's an incredible inspiration here. Before we wrap up this episode, I don't want to end it in a negative way, but again, the negative response of the press. Would you enlighten all of us who don't necessarily understand Yoko Ono's singing style and what she was bringing to music and what she was trying to symbolize vocally, if you will, for all of us?
So Yoko wasn't into music per se as much as sound. You know, she listened to 12-tone composers. She was with John Cage on tour. And she listened to kabuki and no theater, which is kind of exaggerated emotional shrieks and is very shrill. So when she started the screaming, and there's a whole chapter in the book called Queen of the Scream, and explains all her influences and why. And the main reason is that she was told not to go to the servants' quarters when she was a child, because they were talking about adult things. But she did sneak away to go one day, and a girl was talking about her aunt in childbirth emitting these horrible shrieks, because you have to realize in the 30s when Yoko was a child, and even now, you know, Japanese people are very reserved, and they weren't. But women especially weren't supposed to speak up more than a whisper, let alone scream. So this was revelatory to her. And she felt that, wow, that I can let out what I'm feeling. It's natural to do that. And it's a powerful thing that a woman has. We give birth and we express this. So that's where it came from. And everything she did was outside the realm of conventional music. She said, you know, people are fine with hearing the screech of a Concorde in the air, but they're not comfortable with a woman not singing a pretty song. And that wasn't her concept. She always just went with the natural flow of what was expressing her emotionally. So that was her take.
Well, you and I spoke a little bit about this, but your take on her, on the Chuck Berry moment on television, you said she was fine with it. That was that she was okay with it, but that you kind of chalked it up to, you know, that's like one bad getting drunk episode, and that's all people ever remember you by. But talk about those moments where she, a little bit more of what you're saying, of this idea of screaming and how she was so juxtaposed to, let's say, this now traditional rock and roll idea of a Chuck Berry.
Yeah, well, you know, they were hosting the Mike Douglas show in 1972, and John wanted, they got to choose all the guests, and John got his idol Chuck Berry up there, and his other idol is Yoko. So he put the two of them together, and it wasn't necessarily a good fit, and it's become a meme, you know, it's kind of nutty, but it's there, and that's what people are seeing, and it's not important. It's not the thing that Yoko is about. There's so much more to her. Musically and in every other way. So that's unfortunate that that's the thing that's out there. And Yoko doesn't deny it or what do you call it, reject it. She did what she was going to do at that moment. She's not saying, "Oh, I'm sorry I did that." But I just think that is not what people should be judging her by.
Well, I have to say, I agree with you, and I am so grateful that you have embarked and delivered this incredible book about Yoko Ono's extraordinary life. And in this case, let's underscore extraordinary. And she brings so many facets to all of our lives. I've been breathing in your words through her ever since I got the book. So tell everybody before we end this episode where they can find this masterpiece.
So it's on Amazon for those of you internationally. That's probably your best bet shipping wise. But to get the book directly from me with the option of having it signed, and only the hardcover is available through me as well, it's conceptualbooks.com. And it's also available through BookBaby if you're on that site or but yeah, that's where you can get it. And I hope you do because it's not just a book about Yoko. It's a healing, it's healing. It's wise. There's sage quotes throughout the whole book. One reviewer calls it page after page of wisdom.
Oh, I love
So.
that. Well, and to repeat myself, I find it inspiring. I find her so inspiring, and I can't thank you enough. So we will pick this up on the next episode. So until then,